Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson. In the UK, we've just seen two air shows finish. That is, of course, the Royal International Air Tattoo and Farnborough. I was intrigued to see what goes on behind the scenes in a build-up and how one goes about marketing an air show and, in fact, airports. So to help us better understand the challenge, we're joined by Helen Webb. And Helen is the founder and director of International Airshow Marketing. Helen's also a trustee of Flying Scholarships for Disabled People. She's a board member of the European Council of Air Shows, is the chief marketing officer of Circularity, which is a sustainable aviation fuel organisation. And in her spare time, whatever she's managed to squeeze in to all of that, she's also a STEM ambassador. So Helen, welcome to Extended.
Thank you.
It's a delight to have you. I know you're recovering from Riyadh and Farnborough, but you're a very, very busy person. And I've been watching you through social media and really, really enjoying the content that you're promoting there. But I recognise there was something more behind all of this. But before we get into that, where does aviation come into your blood? Because it seems that it runs through it thick and fast.
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting, really, because I didn't really think that I was an av geek until, well, I don't know, fairly recently. I just thought it was normal that everyone likes aircraft, anything to do with engineering, cars. I mean, my first love was cars, and then my sort of first real job was in the railway industry. So I've always liked that sort of engineering side of things. Yeah. But I actually was brought up near Filton in Bristol in the 70s, when obviously that was the heyday of all of the aerospace companies there. And my dad actually worked for a company that supplied a lot of the aerospace companies. So I got to go to the Filton air days and open days. My mum said there's pictures of me waving at Concorde. So obviously somewhere it sparked an interest. And then it's actually 20 years ago, I was living in Fairford. I knew that the air show took place, but my brother-in-law is actually serving Royal Air Force, and he was coming to the show bringing the Nimrod down from Kinloss at the time.
Okay, interesting.
Yes. So I kind of had seen it from the outside, but I then got a ticket and came into the show, and obviously as friends and family sat on the wing of the Nimrod watching it, and I was very sort of interested and thought, oh, I wonder if they ever need any help with marketing. So the next couple of years, I kept my eyes peeled. And then when the job as Deputy Director Marketing for the Air Tattoo came up a few years later, it was in 2007, I applied. And the rest, as they say, is history. I started there at the beginning of 2008. The first show was actually the cancellation show because of the weather and the 90th anniversary of the Royal Air Force and the Queen's visit. So it was a bit of a sort of baptism of fire or baptism of flood. And then
had you done any aviation related marketing before that?
No, it's always
always
been sort of travel and transport, but sort of never got into the planes bit, done the trains and automobiles at that point. But I was just intrigued. I love travel from early age. I love going on aircraft. And then I was definitely sort of targeting that role. And when it came up, I applied, and Tim Prince gave me the job. And so I was there. I was there for 14 years, which was an amazing experience.
Right. Okay. What else did you do in the aviation sector during that time? Was that a bit of a platform, or how did you grow into being more of a holistic aviation air show and airport expert?
Well, I think being involved in such an air show of the size of the Air Tattoo, you can't help but then be exposed to military aviation, civil aviation. I mean, they say that RAF Fairford is sort of the busiest airport in the UK on the departure day on the Monday after the Air Tattoo. So you kind of get to understand everything about aviation through working at that size of air show. So that was my main my sort of main role. And then I got invited to speak at air show events all around the world, as the Air Tattoo was seen as sort of the world leader in terms of both the aircraft it attracts and the scale and the type of marketing that we did to get the public there and to make it commercially viable.
Right.
So all of those things have now sort of gone into the roles that I'm working on now. Now that I've started my own consultancy.
So what does an air show and aviation marketing person like you actually do? What's involved in the job you do? Because it seems like a bit of a myth of what happens and then all of a sudden an air show appears. But I don't think it's like that, is it? I work in marketing, so I understand there's a bit more to it, but no idea what you would do to market an airport or an air show.
Well, I mean, in terms of an air show, I mean, at the Air Tattoo, we had sort of a 16-month cycle. So you were planning the next one before that year's had even happened. So, and that generally was in terms of, right, agreeing what the themes were going to be, because the Air Tattoo really has always been based around a theme, whether it's, for example, the 50th anniversary of the F-16 or a NATO anniversary or something to sort of hang participation on and get people interested. So those themes were usually decided along with various sort of air forces that were involved. So that would happen. And then the sort of the pricing schedule would all be looked at and agreed. And so all of that was done before the event took place. So it's absolutely pure marketing strategy. So we all used to do a very, very comprehensive survey of visitors, not only just the visitors, but then the VIPs and as well as the traders. So we had a huge amount of both qualitative and quantitative information. Again, all the ticket purchase sales, that was all analysed, date of purchase, type of person purchasing, where they lived, where they and we used to use a lot of UTM links, so we would track all of the sales through every piece of marketing that we did. There was a lot of, it was absolutely pure marketing strategy, research, before we even started implementing the actual tactical plan. And that is absolutely what every organization needs. I just happen to like aviation and have found that there is definitely a gap in the market and a niche for someone that understands you need to wear your high-vis and your PPE if you're going onto a live airfield and the designations of aircraft and all of those type of things are actually really important if you're working in a very specialised sector.
And let me come back to, I'm intrigued about some of that demographic data as well, because I live in a universe where I love aeroplanes and lots of people around me do. What is the sort of general demographic of a punter that goes to RIA outside of people like me with telescopic lenses who want to take the killer shot?
Well, actually, I mean, you'll find that, I mean, I did a presentation once and the demographic was based on whether people just had seen the red arrows and wanted to see them again, right through to the will travel across from Australia with a lens larger than my car to come and see the Air Tattoo. So you could split the sort of demographic in various ways. And a lot of people are just interested in an interesting family day out. And to be honest, as long as you get the aircraft that the more sort of hardcore aviation people want, then you'll get them there. So they will find you out. So in terms of targeting those sort of people, we didn't really need to do that. It was just about really good communications about how we got aircraft, who we were talking to, doing the aircraft announcements every Thursday at midday, Which then obviously saw a huge spike in visitors to the website and if you had a specific type of aircraft. But those sort of people, that it was all down to what aircraft you got, regardless of whether the sun was going to shine. And then you have the other type of people that will leave it till the last minute, which is why I had a really audacious goal. And he said to my team that we want to be like Glastonbury. We put the tickets on sale at 9 o'clock one morning, and by 10 o'clock they're sold out. I mean, that is a very audacious goal, but that's how it started. That is what has started to happen. So people do buy in advance, and therefore you take the weather and the weather forecast out of the equation.
If you leave
it to the weather gods to decide on your ticket sales, then you may be disappointed. So that was one of the things, was we needed to sell out early to ensure that the weather was taken out of the equation. So it's a very...
And that's happened, hasn't it? That's, you know, I regularly see the messages, that's it, a few tickets left for this day, get in quickly, blah, blah, blah. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, and that is exactly what that audacious goal was, to make us think about how do we get to that point that we sell out in advance of the show. And it was funny when the first I can't remember how long ago it was, the first time that we were about to sell out of the Saturday tickets, which always sell out first, we put information out, we sent emails and on social media that there were only so many 1,000 tickets left, and they sold out and there were none left. And then people were saying, oh, well, we thought you were just saying that. It's like, well, no, you weren't just saying that. We're being honest. We're trying to help you. So people have learned, though, it's not a marketing or sales trick to get people to buy tickets early. It's actually, we're trying to tell you that if you don't buy now, you're not going to get to come on that day. So,
and has that in itself added to the attraction of the event? That sort of uniqueness, it sells out, you know, it's really popular. There's a reason. Because I had a colleague who sent me a message on the... I got it on Sunday, but he sent it on Saturday to say, are you here? You at React? Now, I could not in a billion years have guessed a person more inappropriate to be at an air show than this guy. He was there with his family and he had an absolute blast. It was fascinating. And I just wondered how people that outside our community got attracted into what now has become, as you say, it's a bit like the music events where get in quick, get in fast, because this is really special.
And it's on the, I mean, if you think about it, I used to say it was the Glastonbury or the F1 of air shows. So when you start looking at those sort of scales and that level of marketing and attraction and the FOMO, fear of missing out, that is when you know you've created a brand that people want to be associated with, even if they don't really understand until they get there what it is they're going to. And it's just the noise, the experience, all of the additional things, that seeing huge aircraft parked up on the pan, that you just don't get that at really any other event. And you can see I'm still really enthusiastic about it.
I know, I'm thinking of booking my ticket for next year already. I'm feeling like that. Then Helen, how does React sit then in, you know, we talked just before we came on about some other air shows around the world. Where does it sort of sit outside the trade shows of Paris and Farnborough and things? Where does React sit in that sort of hierarchy? Because I feel like, and I don't know if it's because I'm British and it's here, that it's right near the top now. You know, it's a Miramar, it's a React, it's a, you know, is it really in those sorts of areas?
It's funny because when I'm asked to speak at airshow conferences around the world, and when I say that I'm from React, people, it's like you're a celebrity and you're sort of airshow royalty. And people say, oh, I've always wanted to come and visit. That's all on my bucket list. And this is the people that run huge air shows in other places around the world, because it has this sort of reputation, and rightly so, for being quite a unique event. And I think that is because of the way that it was started, I mean, it started by volunteers and how it's grown over the last 53 years, but it actually is not like any other event. It's a hybrid between a Farnborough or a Paris or a Dubai trade show, but that isn't going on publicly, but there is a lot of networking and VIP meetings behind closed doors. And then because of that, you get all of the aircraft from around the world because their chief of staff is there being hosted, and they want to see their aircraft both in the sky and on the pan. So it is, it's a hybrid really of a normal public air show and then a trade event.
Yeah. And does it, I mean, it's to me, again, my perception is it's very much a military, or it feels like it's a very military focus. That's not entirely true either, is it?
No, I mean, there are a lot of civilian aircraft there. I mean, we had the Cranfield University aircraft there. We had quite a few electric aircraft. There's been DHL, British Airways. It's not just military aircraft. Obviously, that's quite a large proportion, but it is not solely. And I think we'll probably see more civilian aircraft attending as the types of military aircraft sort of decrease. As you've got however many countries all using the Typhoon, however many countries all using the F-35. So the numbers and types of aircraft are reducing. So to fill that, there will be definitely a demand and also an interest, particularly with sustainable aviation, to showcase the new technologies that are out there.
Well, hi everyone. Steve Fisher here from Plane Crazy Down Under, Australia's aviation show.
And I'm Grant McCarran from the same damn show.
And I'm Brian Coleman, not from Plane Crazy Down Under.
Hang on a minute. Who was that guy?
I don't know. Someone seems to have snuck in on the recording. I think it's Brian. Oh, my God. Hi.
It's a global traveler. Yeah. Thought I'd decide to crash your party.
Brian, you're doing some global traveling.
I am. I am so looking forward to seeing you guys at the Gold Coast.
Yeah, despite our best efforts, border control's going to let them in, apparently. So we're all going to get together for the Pacific Air Show Gold Coast.
Yeah, since you guys wouldn't come to the version up here in the Northern Hemisphere at Huntington Beach, I had to come all the way down to Australia and visit you guys.
I know. We appreciate the effort, and it's going to be on the 16th, 17th, and 18th of August, so not far before Huntington Beach. Please let us know if you're going to be at the show, because we're going to organise a few meetups and catch up with people. There may be beer involved. Can't guarantee there won't be.
Yes, and Brian's buying, so the more the merrier.
Tinnies for everyone.
Something about the exchange rate, right?
It is in my favor this week, isn't it?
Not too late to get your tickets, folks. Head on down to the Gold Coast and we will see you all there.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Let me just jump back then, Helen, to your role with Circularity. Just mentioned sustainable aviation there. How critical is that to the future, do you think, of aviation? Obviously, you see it as being a really important aspect of the sector going forwards. Otherwise, you wouldn't be involved in something like that. But that's coming more and more both into military and civilian aviation. What sort of pressure do you have on you when you're marketing an event to prove that it's a sustainable event? Because there's lots of, it's noisy, it's a waste of fuel, you know, it's fossil fuel, blah, 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 you know, from outside the sector.
Yeah,
how important is it that it demonstrates and presents itself?
Yes, I think one of the things that I'm working with Circularity is synthetic sustainable aviation fuel. Because obviously there are like 8 pathways into sustainable aviation fuel, and some of them aren't actually very sustainable if you look what the feedstock that is being used. I mean, we're getting into the whole palm oil, destroying the rainforest, people not eating so that we can buy, so that we can grow feedstock, so that we can fuel aircraft, which obviously is not the purpose of changing an ecosystem because we want to replace fossil fuel is not why we're here. So which is why I'm with Circularity, which is a synthetic like drop-in that actually doesn't change an ecosystem or destroy the planet further, trying to create it. But it is the most difficult form of sustainable aviation fuel. But in terms of carrying large quantities of passengers for long haul, really it is the only option that we've got. Whilst electric and electric hydrogen, etc., are really great, and new sort of eVTOLs, realistically, they are not going to save the sort of long haul market. And when you looked at the orders that took place at Farnborough and earlier in the year, sort of Dubai and then Paris, those aircraft are current aircraft. They're going to be around for the next 30 to 50 years. We have to have some way of making them more sustainable because they're here, and that is what the future really in terms of mass transit or mass air travel is. So I wouldn't be involved in something that I didn't believe was the right choice. Unfortunately, those sort of, it's not the sexy choice, and therefore all of the investment and the funding is going into the eVTOL, new tech, electric aircraft, which, yes, we can train our pilots in electric aircraft. That would be great. But in terms of mass transit and traveling as we do at the moment, which we are going to carry on, people are not going to stop flying, however much they say that we shouldn't be destroying the planet. So I think my time and effort is being put into something that I believe really is worthwhile. And I'm sure there are people that will disagree with me, but everyone's entitled to their opinion. And in terms of air shows, I mean, we saw that at the Air Tattoo, the RAF Typhoon display was on a 10% blend of SAF, which is great because then that's talked about in the commentary. So all of those people there at the Air Tattoo will hear about it. And then also in terms of air shows and also Farnborough did have a big sort of Pioneers Day on the Friday. I mean, the Air Tattoo has been doing that for years, and there's thousands and thousands of kids that come in for free on the Friday. Plus, they have an under 18s go free policy. I don't know any other event that does that.
Yeah.
And the whole point is that the people that are coming in that are young and will be getting inspired by aviation and what they see around them, plus all of the activities that are in the sort of STEM area, which is the techno zone, which are being staffed by so many different companies that understand that the sort of the future of aviation is really dependent on the number of young people that we can encourage to come into an industry, which in their mind may not be the most sustainable and attractive industry to go in. I mean, Formula One have done a fantastic job of persuading people that they are going to be sustainable by 2030. It pops up on the screen behind the winners every time, but I'm not entirely sure how they then transport all of their cars and kit to the next location and how is that sustainable. So there's a lot of education to be done, but I particularly think with aviation and young people, so because they are the ones that are going to invent and carry on these new technologies and effectively sort of decarbonize the sector. So we need them to be inspired by aviation and flying and want to be in this sector as a career.
Yeah. Okay. Let me bring you back to marketing then. And it's a question, I suppose it's a philosophical one for us sales and marketing people. What's the difference between marketing an air show and PR? What's it, where do the two sort of separate?
Well, I mean, marketing, when you start with your marketing objectives and your goals and your strategy, there are then a number of different ways that you can deliver that. And PR is part of the whole marketing mix, along with advertising, social media, and PR is in there. TV advertising, newspaper, magazine. I'm showing my age then. We used to do newspaper print
advertising. Oh, I don't think so.
Yes. Yeah. So YouTube advertising, all of those activities feed into your tactical plan. And PR is very much part of that. I mean, but PR is a difficult one because you can't control how the media then present your message. So This is quite difficult in terms of what we were talking about the sort of the perception that aviation isn't necessarily sustainable. And obviously there are lots of once a story leaves you because of the nature of it being free, PR is people, oh great, PR is free. You then don't have any control. So it is a really important part of the sort of marketing mix because you have no control. Therefore, people believe it because it is then put out by a news agency. And so then you believe that news agency. But there's a huge number of things that come into PR, influencers, getting ambassadors, all of. So the line between paid for PR, which PR is not meant to be paid for, but when you're starting to use influencers and ambassadors and they're paid, is that still PR? So that's quite an interesting sort of dilemma for all sort of marketing people going forward. The lines are really blurred between different
areas. Social media's done that, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about some of your other clients. I know, again, following you work with airports as well. What sort of challenges do you have working to market airports?
One of my sort of main roles is at Gloucestershire Airport at the moment, and Gloucestershire Airport is the busiest general aviation airport in the UK. It had nearly 70,000 movements last year. It's got two or three big training schools, Aeros and also Skyborne, who are looking after a lot of the airlines cadet training now. You've got Castle Air Academy on helicopter training, heli flight, and a huge number of different maintenance type of organisation, as well as charter and business jets. And all the sort of general aviation that comes in and out as well, sort of the pleasure flying. So that type of sort of mixture, and also we get Apaches and Chinooks in there quite often as well.
Okay, so right.
I'm living the dream. that's a really, really interesting sort of mix. So that organisation is half owned by Gloucestershire County Council and half owned by Cheltenham Borough Council.
That's a challenge.
Another interesting
politics.
We also know that councils are having a hard time in terms of their budgets at the moment, and airports do need significant investment to keep them sort of commercially viable, and Gloucestershire is such a brilliant airport, the future's interesting. I mean, it's a lot of local community relations, and because there are 50 or so really great companies on site, so continued communication, but as we know, the aviation industry is constantly changing, it's like being at an air show 365 days a year. There's no build up. It is constant.
Just constant.
It opens seven days a week.
And is there an ambition for airports like Gloucester to become more commercial from a passenger perspective? Do they see potential for that? Or is there growth very much in the general aviation environment?
I don't think for Gloucestershire Airport, there isn't really the facilities there to run a commercial operation. The runway isn't long enough to have in the sort of the EasyJets or sort of British Airways flights. But there's definitely a lot that can be done there with both the general aviation, the business and the training. It's a great location, lots of opportunities for events, for filming, for films, and TV programs. I get quite a few requests come through. It's just making sure that it's known as a sort of a vibrant general aviation and business hub. And there are opportunities for having hangarage there. So my role is very varied, but there's so many parallels between running an air show and running an airport.
Yeah. And are you involved in any other air shows or airports?
I've got quite a few other air show clients, Rich Goodwin Air Shows. Display participants. He's great with his pit special and the new sort of jet turbines he's put onto that. So he's an ex-RAF Tornado pilot, then a TUI commercial pilot, and now a display pilot. So that's a really exciting, interesting project. He was actually displaying at the Pioneers Day at Farnborough and then doing a whole STEM program for them as well. So again, it's just all these things linked together in my life.
We've spoken to Rich on the program I think a couple of times actually. The thing that astounds me is his energy. His energy is unbelievable. He goes and does what is an extremely intensive display, gets out the plane, runs over, and has more energy than I have to talk to me. He's amazing.
Yeah, he is. And I think that's like from a STEM perspective as well. That's really inspiring for young people to see sort of how your career in aviation can progress.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to just be a pilot. I mean, there's lots of other opportunities. And I think that's really important to explain to people. I mean, there's some really great programs that happen at Gloucestershire Airport with Fly to Help and their sort of Aim High program of sort of local schools and people that come in to see what opportunities there are in various different organizations that are based on the airfield. I mean, be a fireman, you can cut the grass, you can still be involved in aviation. You don't just have to be a pilot. And I think that's really important for people to understand, particularly sort of in some of the areas sort of in Gloucester that aren't so affluent. I mean, everyone presumes that the Cotswolds is very affluent, but it's actually not.
Areas of deprivation there, aren't there?
Some parts of Cheltenham as well. So I think, it's a big employer. So I think it just needs to be, showcased more, which is what my role is. I mean, there's a huge sort of cyber development in Gloucestershire as well. So if the airport can be aligned with that. So it's just, just exciting times. Who knows what will happen in the future, but it's definitely a vibrant sort of aviation hub that needs to be sort of kept and looked after.
I'm going to come back to the future in a minute because I want to ask you some questions about some exciting things you might or might not be able to talk about. But I wanted to ask you about being a board member of the European Council of Air Shows. What's involved with that? We don't really get to see or hear much about the council, but occasionally bump into people who do. And it always sounds like a really exciting place to be. But I've no context of what I'm putting that into. What do they do? What's your role? How does it all operate?
So, I mean, we have similar in the UK. I used to be on the committee for the British Air Displays Association, and now I'm on the board of the European Air Show Council. And then in the States, they've got the International Council of Air Shows. And it's the sort of representative body for all of those that work and run air shows. And that can be from the event organizer perspective. It can be from the display participants' perspective. So it's a really it's a really interesting organization, but it does have a huge focus on safety and safety standards. And that's where the organizations work alongside, particularly in the UK, alongside the CAA and the MAA, in terms of upholding the sort of the display standards, but also the regulatory requirements. You can't just have a plane and decide you're going to go and do a display with the red arrows. There's training, and there are certain things. I mean, you hear about the red arrows, they have to get their public display authority. Yeah, so it's similar for anyone that wants to display. And this is why air shows, sometimes you will only get a fly past, because if someone hasn't got the right authorities, you can't have an actual display. You can only have a fly past. So that's the regulatory side of it. So it's safety, regulatory, and also trying to sort of work out what the future of air shows are in terms of both being commercially viable and sustainably viable going forward. And I wrote an article for the Standout magazine, which is the big magazine for the outdoor events industry. And a lot of the issues are similar across all outdoor events at this point in time. I mean, I think more and more events being cancelled because it's just not commercially viable. I think a 40% increase in things like toilets and trackway and marquees after COVID and Brexit. And so it's you can't increase your ticket prices. How do you look at other ways of becoming commercially viable? So all of these things I've talked about happen, but it's great when you go to them. And I was at the European Air Displays Convention in Brussels, and I was sat next to someone. I said, "Oh, what do you do?" And he said, "Oh, I'm the Canadian F-18 pilot for this year." I was like,
"Wow!" Yeah,
so then you have really interesting conversations.
Yeah,
it's a world that I feel very privileged to be part of. So
yeah, I wish my sales and marketing career had now been in aviation. I'm very, very jealous.
It's never too late. I need some more help.
True. Okay. Maybe. Tell us about the future then, Helen. Let's talk about your business, where it's growing, and where you'd like to see things evolve going forwards. Obviously, I suspect you're planning for 25 and 26 already.
Yeah, so I've got quite a range of aviation clients, and particularly I spoke to a few people at Farnborough who are interested. So I start from the point of stop wasting money on social media before you've actually done your strategy and you've found out and defined what you want to achieve, who your customers actually are, why are you different, why are they going to buy from you. So those classic marketing things. So I usually carry out a workshop, and then what I've been finding is that people then want me to help implement the marketing sort of strategy and plans that I've come up with. So I'm now growing into a sort of a one or two woman consultancy to a full aviation marketing agency, which is obviously very exciting. But I've got lots of contacts that are happy to be part of this. So that's very exciting. And my original concept was always to provide companies in the aviation sector with a sort of what we did at the Air Tattoo, the team that I had at the Air Tattoo that were amazing, where we delivered both from a marketing perspective and a event customer experience, the research, all of those sort of things that I can offer. And so that's where I'm building the team. But I would love to get back involved with another sort of big air show. So that would be fantastic.
Okay. So are you now ready for a break, or do you just keep, or is this a busy time? I don't know. What do the cycles work like? Because I know friends and colleagues who have done Riyadh and Farnborough, this week is press sort of debrief and press week. But after that, they're like, "We're done. We need a break." How does it work in your business?
Well, when I worked for the Air Tattoo, that was kind of the that was the pattern. However, being in marketing, you can never stop, because then there was all the survey to do with the analysis ready to put the tickets on sale again. So actually, people thought that you only worked for 3 months a year, but it was not. It was very much a whole year sort of cycle. It's the same now. I look at my diary and think, wow, between now and Christmas, it's going to be good. It's going to be busy. And
how fabulous.
That's how I like it.
So. Yeah, how fabulous. Really, really. It's just great to hear a success story as well in a sector that we've never really considered talking to people about. So it's really interesting to hear what happens behind the scenes. Before I let you go, Helen, I know you recently decided to try your hand at your own general aviation trial lesson. Tell us about that experience and what it's brought to what you do.
Yeah, so I kind of thought after all these years of being involved in marketing, I really should sort of put my money where my mouth was. And for a recent birthday, big birthday, I thought I should actually try my hand at flying. So I had a flying lesson from RAF Bryce Norton Flying Club, and I had a really, really weird experience. I think it's called Flicker Vertigo. The propeller sort of, I had no sort of then sense of distance, height, where I was. And I mean I love flying normally, but even yeah. I was like, I don't want to look down at the ground. I can't see where wow. I'm supposed to be going. So yeah, it wasn't a great.
And did you never experience that before? You must have been up in, gosh, how you must have been up in so many different types of airplanes. Did you never experience that before?
Never, where I was looking straight out of the front through a prop. I mean,
yeah,
a lot in a flex wing microlite, but then the props behind me.
Yeah,
I stood on the door of the BBMF Dakota, hanging out of the door. Didn't have any problems with that. So I've been in helicopters, and I've never, but yeah. It must have been something about the light and the propeller. But anyway, but what it does do is it gives me massive sort of appreciation of how amazing our Flying Scholars for Disabled People are with their sort of their own challenges. And so many of them get to solo and even become pilots. And my sort of admiration for them has massively increased, because yeah. I definitely couldn't do it. I might try gliding. I don't know.
Well, you know what the answer is? Fly jets.
Yes. I wonder if anyone will lend me one.
Well, you need to speak nicely to that CF-18 pilot next time you sat next to him. See if he could get yes. you in his... in his back seat. Helen, it's been a really, really fascinating discussion to learn a bit more about what you do and how you operate. Where can we find you online?
So my website is airshow.marketing, just www.airshow.marketing, or I'm on LinkedIn a lot, and you'll get to see my my videos from standing at the end of RAF Fairford runway when the U2 or the B-52s are around. So on LinkedIn, I'm Helen Webb, FCIM, and that's Fellow of the Chartered Institute of Marketing, for those that wondered what the my name. So yeah, Helen Webb, FCIM.
Okay, and we'll put links to you and to the business in the show notes. Helen, it's been fantastic to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian. And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter X. And you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads and Instagram feeds. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.